In American society, money is a taboo topic. We're taught at a young age it's improper to talk about it, but we're also bombarded with messages about the power and importance of money in our everyday lives. And by not talking about it, we miss out on the skills and lessons we need to effectively understand and financially plan. That changes today. Welcome to Money Tales. Hosted by Sandy Brager and Cami Doder, Money Tales brings more than 35 years of combined professional experience in personal finance to demystify money and demonstrate what it's like to speak openly about personal financial matters. Join us each episode as they interview modern-day movers and shakers about how money decisions intertwine with their daily lives in order to give you better insight into productive financial conversations. Subscribe today and register for our blog Fathom at esperient.com/podcasts to increase your money mojo. And now, here's Cami and Sandy.
This week on Money Tales, Rena DeLevy is our guest. As Rena looks back on the early days of her career, she regrets her harsh leadership style at the time, which she attributes to learning from those around her. To quote Rena, "I was an asshole. I learned from the best, and I really threatened and intimidated. It did not feel good." By the time she hit her mid-30s, Rena was done. The asshole persona was a ruse that took too much energy to keep up. Rena realized that, at her core, she's sensitive, empathetic, and intense. She couldn't keep herself bottled up any longer. She needed to be herself. Making a move likely meant stepping away from the corporate ladder that was paying her handsomely. However, Rena knew in her heart, at that moment, she needed authenticity more than money. Today, Rena is a compassionate leadership coach. She wrote the book, Compassionate Management: How Ambitious Creatives Become Kick-Ass Leaders. That and her TEDx talk titled Compassionate Management: Using Compassion as a Business Tool have been used in businesses around the globe as a model to radically change leadership culture and how we treat one another.
Here are three key money topics Rena hits on in this conversation. First, how being driven by authenticity and heart work has impacted her personal finances. Second, how living in the deep and the vulnerable plays out in Rena's uses of money. And third, why it's counterproductive and extremely expensive to use fear as a leadership tool in business. We hope you share this episode with a friend, and please subscribe to Money Tales on your favorite podcast platform. Now onto our conversation with Rena DeLevy.
Welcome to the Money Tales podcast. I'm Cami Doder.
And I'm Sandy Brager.
Sandy, I've got my money story for you today that is involved with taking a car in to get serviced.
Ooh, that's not a fun money conversation, I don't think.
I know, especially I've already admitted I don't love cars. But I was being a responsible adult. The family and I were going on a road trip. And I thought, you know, it's been about a year. I should get this serviced. And that doesn't cost that much money. Go be an adult and do it. So I did. And of course, I get the call.
Dun, dun, dun.
Yeah, exactly. Well, there's a few other things we need to take care of.
Of course there are.
Yeah. And I needed new tires. Oh, those are expensive. And I'm like, really? They looked great. So I'm on speakerphone at this point, and I'm with my daughter. And the mechanic said, and it'll cost, and it was a large sum of money. Crazy how expensive tires are. And so I said, okay, thank you so much. That sounds like the right approach. Let's get the tires. And we hang up. My daughter's face was white. I mean, she was aghast at this number.
And remind listeners how old your daughter is, this particular daughter.
That's a good point. She's 7. And so she's getting a sense of that's a lot of money. And she says to me first thing, "Mommy, mommy, please don't do that."
Oh no.
And I said, "Oh, Riley, we have to do that to be safe. You know, you have to take care of your things." "Mommy, I'm going to give you my money." So sweet.
Was she worried that you guys couldn't afford it?
Must have been. So at first I thought, oh gosh, I wish I hadn't been on speakerphone. And then I realized what a great opportunity to have a conversation about our values and what money's for us and how important it is how lucky we are to have our house and our car and two jobs. My husband and I both work. And to have that conversation and then to tie it back to why. Why do we work and what is the money for? And for us, it's to create these opportunities for this road trip, to be safe and have fresh tires. I'm not sure she fully got it.
I was going to ask if she brought up the tires on the drive.
She has brought up the tires a couple of times, like how expensive it is. And I think that's okay. I don't want her to be fearful of spending money, but it does give an opportunity to go back to, this is really important to us.
Sure. And gives her a sense of what the world costs. Certainly she's not spending in that realm just yet.
It's a start. As you know, we play Monopoly and that's just funny money. So we'll talk about that another time.
What a great experience for her, Cammie. Thanks for sharing that.
It was really great. Well, I get to welcome our guest today, Rina DeLevy. It is wonderful to welcome you onto the podcast.
Thank you. I'm so happy to be here.
Would you please introduce yourself and in doing so, share a couple pivotal moments that have taken place in your life, really impacting who you are today?
My name is Rina DeLevy, as you said, and I, for the past 18 years, have been running my own business, teaching compassionate leadership in the corporate workspace. My commitment all these years has been to eradicate fear in the workplace, which is why I have a lot of gray hair and I'm tired. It's hard work. It's very meaningful. It's not always welcome. And sometimes it is desperately welcome. That's life, both and.
You said it's heart work.
Yes.
I love that.
That speaks directly to my relationship with money. I have never been driven by money, which is both a gift and a pain in the butt. Because when I worked in corporate in-house for about 18 years before I started my business, I made a lot of money and I rose up the corporate ladder and I was a fear-based leader. I was an asshole. I learned from the best and I threatened and intimidated and it did not feel good. At around maybe 35 years old, something like that, I said, I'm done. I can't keep not being who I am, which is sensitive, empathetic, and intense. And I was hiding all of that. And so I said, I'm done. I got to just be me. And if I don't rise up the ladder, if I get fired, so be it. If I were really so in love with money more than authenticity, I would have stayed. I'd be making millions hand over fist by now. But I am driven by authenticity and heart work. So I ended up taking a pay cut dramatically when I went into my own business to teach how to not be a fear-based manager. Over the years, as running your own business goes, some years I made a lot of money, other years I made very little. It takes tenacity and commitment to being authentic, to stay with running your own business and the roller coaster of it. It's been incredibly satisfying and meaningful.
What a wonderful story. I can't wait to dive into what causes some businesses and even some industries that tend to attract that fear-based approach. But before we do, we'd love to start from the beginning and hear more about your backstory that builds into your life money story. Could you tell us when you were growing up, when did money start having meaning to you?
So I was probably 10 years old. And my dad and I had gone to some sort of craft fair. I saw this tiny little porcelain doll and I fell in love. And it was $75, which in today's money would probably be a couple of hundred, maybe 500, a lot of money.
A lot for a 10-year-old.
Approaching the cost of a tire, I bet.
I was just going to say, Sandy.
And I was like, Dad, I want it. And he was like, Rina, no, you're not getting it. And I was devastated. And that memory has stayed with me, constantly comes up in my mind. And my relationship to that experience changed over time. I think I held on to resentment and why can't I have it for many years, being a teenager, certainly any excuse to be angry with my parents. But as I got older, it was like, what was I thinking? That's ridiculous to be upset about that. With that introspection of how our view of the world changes, at this point, I'm like, oof, so glad he didn't get that for me, because it really was an incredibly pivotal moment of understanding the value of money.
Yeah, that's fascinating. Have you ever talked to your father about that particular incident?
No, I need to call him today. Thank God he's still alive and I can have that conversation.
Just curious to know if he knew what an impact it was on you.
Or even remembers it. Isn't it funny? They plant these little seeds. And like you say, it could be a trigger at the moment and a learning moment.
Have you gone back and bought any porcelain dolls in your life?
No, I have no interest.
That moment is stuck with you, but that desire.
I think to more directly answer your question, if I really still wanted a porcelain doll, I would have gotten it for myself. I have invested in things that make me happy. I have a nice collection of oil paintings that I love that I bought before I had my child, when I was in corporate and making money and buying things that bring me joy. I'm not stingy with myself. I'm just thoughtful.
Do you think that even investing in not being stingy with yourself, but making sure it's important to you, do you think that's a lesson that you took away from that time with your dad?
Maybe. I think it's a bigger picture. My parents taught us to save, spend, and share. They didn't use those words, but I watched and witnessed. And when everyone else in seventh grade was getting Sassoon jeans, circa 1979 or whatever, 1980, I was like, I want Sassoon. Even so-and-so next door got the Sassoons. And my mom was like, we're going to Sears and we're going to get you 12 slim boys jeans. And I was like, I can't believe it. But we were classic 1970s middle class. Both my parents worked, which was unusual for a mom to work at that time. We were not wealthy financially, but I never wanted for anything. On my mom's side, her parents grew up in the Depression. So my grandmother, we'd go to a restaurant and she would take the rolls with her after the kind of standard Jewish grandmother, take them home because we can't throw it out. And my father's side, survivors of the Holocaust. So there's this hypervigilance that's in my DNA that also touches on money, making sure that you have enough of everything. I've really embraced that. I always save. I definitely spend on myself within reason because I really have to want it. And then sharing, always, no matter how little I've made, I've always given to a charity or somebody.
Rena, I'm curious, how do you know when you really want something?
I listen to my heart. Sometimes I'll go into a store and I'll be like, oh my God, I love that sweater or that shirt. And then I'm like, hold up, are you really going to wear it? Or do you just love the look of it? It's not a self-torture, it's a reflection. Is this really meaningful? Am I really going to wear it? And it's not like every single time I buy something, I go through this whole analysis. But at this point, I can, boom, get to it. Because I am, as I said, sensitive and introspective and intense. And I live in the deep. I live in the vulnerable. That's who I am. And so it's pretty easy for me to look at a sweater and be like, wow, that's beautiful. But I'm so menopausal, I'm never going to wear it. So don't buy it.
You're funny, Rena.
That's wonderful. Rena, you said you've never been driven by money. So when you went into the corporate world and you were the type of leader that you didn't want to be, really wasn't who you are, describe what was driving you at that time.
I am a driven person. I am a perfectionist. And I remember in fourth grade thinking, when can I be done with school? I just want to work. I love working. I love building and developing and guiding and helping and creating. It's just who I am. And when I went to art school to be an art director, graphic designer, I did that because I didn't know what else to do and it was fine. And I've always been an artist. I entered the corporate world at J. Crew, which was really fun. And I was working on the catalog, and then the owner asked me to manage. And he was both inspiring and terrifying. And I was this little young 26-year-old innocent whatever. And I said, okay, because I was just too afraid to say no. Plus, I wasn't really satisfied designing because I was mediocre. And I just am not comfortable with that. And then I loved it. I fell in love with it. And I started doing operational efficiency because it's innate for me. I love a spreadsheet. Love, love, love a spreadsheet. And I started using Excel when here I was this artist. I was like, what is this tool? And then I fell in love with it, which was a shock for me. I've always just followed my heart and intuition and tried the next thing rather than planned out a strategy for my career. That's just not who I am. And so on my iterative path, I fell in love with streamlining and making things easier for people, but I had no training with management. And so I just did what I witnessed because I didn't want to lose my job.
That modeling can be powerful stuff.
It was very clear if you were kind and compassionate, you were out. And if you were threatening, you were being promoted. And so it was a very much a disconnect for me. But I will say that in my childhood, I was always the, where did you come from? My family is very academic and I'm this free spirit. And so they were always a little bit like, who, what? And so I always wanted to fit in. So one other form of fitting in is being the manager that I see the majority of the people being like, which is why at 36, I was like, I'm done. I'm done with fitting in. I'm just going to be who I am. And then I found an incredible therapist who really nurtured that. That's when I began to learn to like who I am and really show up as me, which is why I then went shortly thereafter into my own business, teaching compassionate leadership.
I want to get into your business, but before we go there, as you look back on these corporate years and you're making a lot of money, money wasn't really a focus for you. So what was that like?
Delicious.
How are you relating to money at that time?
I love money. I love it. It makes for enormous freedom. And I was living in New York City. I bought myself an apartment. I bought myself a studio and I put in a Murphy bed and I had custom cabinetry built in over the heating AC unit with cabinets. And I was buying my artwork and I was going out to dinner all the time and seeing shows. I was just living, traveling all over the place. And it was really fun and saving money and also contributing to causes.
So those early lessons from your parents were manifesting at that time.
Oh, yes. And also keep in mind, somehow I ended up in fashion for many years, but I've never been a fashionista. And that's not judgmental. It's just not who I am. My favorite outfit is jeans and a black t-shirt. That's it. The idea of, you know, all this brand name, whatever, I could give a hoot about that. My money never went into any of that. So that was never really a question for me. It definitely made it harder when I worked in fashion and people were like, what are you wearing? And I was like, Target. But that was my commitment to be who I am.
You're living comfortably, you have a nice lifestyle, you're able to save money, you're able to share your money with those who need it. And then you decide you need to be the authentic you and align your career with who you are as a person. So you find this therapist and you go out on your own. What did that feel like?
That really began because I had been working on a documentary on nights and weekends called Spinster Babe, because at that point I was, I guess, 39 and I had never married. I'd been engaged and broken off. I just never met anybody I wanted to spend my life with. And I felt really strongly that I wanted to help specifically young hetero women in colleges and universities. And my commitment to myself was I'm going to make this documentary and then travel around the countries to colleges and universities. The point of the documentary is that you can be happy, single, and open to love, which was the opposite of what I was taught. I was taught you get married.
And that's where happiness was.
Is he circumcised? Great, get married.
Yeah.
I was working on that nights and weekends for a year and a half while I was working at that point at Kenneth Cole, which was really fun. So I was like, I'm done. I need to just edit it. I'd saved up a lot of money. I had tried to buy a bigger apartment. I didn't get it. And I was like, that's it. I'm going to just take this money, edit the film and travel. And that's how my business started, because I quit to finish the film. But because I had been working in New York City for so many years, once people heard I was consulting, they were like, I need you to do this. I need you to do that. And so my consulting business started. And over that period of time, I started codifying compassionate leadership and then wrote a book and did a TEDx talk and built a business.
Which is amazing. Let's dive into that. So the business is Compassionate Leadership. I'm looking at your book right now. It's fantastic. I really even appreciate that you start with the definition around compassion. I think that's a really important point. And I was wondering if you could share, how do you think about, you have to grow your business, you have to make money, you have to hire employees. There's a lot of money in it. I think some people might consider compassionate leadership is not aligned with growth and profitability. And I wondered if you could talk about how you help companies achieve their goals compassionately.
So the bottom line is nurtured by compassion. It is an absolute fallacy that you need to churn and burn your employees to make money, because it is far more expensive to keep replacing employees. It costs 75 to 100% of a person's salary to replace them. And that's hard cost. And then you add in the soft cost of institutional history, relationships with clients, relationships with the vendors, relationships internally, training, sourcing, hiring, orientation, all of that. So it is financially counterproductive to use fear. However, our country is based on greed. And so the corporate culture is based on greed. As we see with all of these people who are hoarding all of this money so that they can build spaceships and whatever to take care of their own ego instead of investing in education and equal rights and all of that. And so the companies and the people at the head of these companies, who quite frankly will die off at some point, I know that's harsh, but that's the truth. They're so brainwashed into greed that they cannot shift away from this paradigm of fear. And so when millennials first arrived, I was in love with them. They were shifting things towards compassion. And now Gen Z, holy cow, as each generation comes in and we're in this quantum shift on this planet, which is the hell that we're living through right now, this real evil versus good that we're living through globally, is the shift from fear to compassion. When somebody says to me, you know, oh my God, can you believe what is happening in the news? And I'm like, follow the money and you'll see what drives that decision.
So I'm curious, given all that you've explained about the work that you're doing and why you're doing it, where does money come up for you at work?
Well, I charge a lot because I'm worth it. And that's taken work.
Just say that again, by the way, please, because so many people struggle with charging for their services. And I want you to say that again.
I charge a lot because I'm worth it. And I do not charge by the hour, because I'm not bringing an hour's worth of skill. I'm bringing 30 whatever years of experience to every minute that you have a conversation with me.
Beautiful. So you're charging a lot. And how would you describe your own personal relationship with money today?
Well, a couple of years ago, I realized I had a really screwed up relationship, and I hired a money coach. She was super Buddhist, and I'm a very Jewish person who's also studied Buddhism for 20 something years. So sort of a Jew boo, more Jewish. Anyway, the mindfulness mentality of the Buddhist concept of 10,000 joys and 10,000 sorrows, the both and, the coexisting truth of life, is something that I have learned to apply to every area, including money. And when I start feeling that fear, I'm never going to have enough. Oh my God, am I going to have enough? I'm going to end up in a box, living in a cardboard box kind of fear. I come back to center and I use the tools of mindfulness and meditation to come back to center and say, you know what? Money always comes, Rena. Just keep doing what you're doing. What I accomplished with the money coach was really walking through my relationship and where that came from. And I think the key for me was the hypervigilance that I was born into is not always helpful.
And that's hard because you said that's in your DNA, which is a real thing. When generations and generations of families experience money trauma, it seeps into that DNA for sure.
I had to acknowledge it, talk about it, work through it. And then the thing with hypervigilance is you can't just say, you know what, I'm not going to be hypervigilant anymore. You have to invite it to the table and say, listen, I hear you, and you're not going to run this conversation. It's that making friends with your anxiety, all of that mindfulness work that I love. And so when you asked, how does money show up with my clients? We rarely ever talk about money. Mostly we talk about what is your experience in your job? What is your experience in the company? How can I help you show up as you? Money will come up if they say, I really want to be promoted, or everyone else is making more money. And then we talk about their relationship to money and mostly their relationship to themselves. Because if you learn to like yourself, then you can ask for the money you're worth. Until then, you're just going to talk yourself out of it.
I mean, it's so powerful that you hired this coach. And as you said, it's an ongoing work. Would you share with our listeners, how did you go about finding a money coach?
I've been in this mindfulness circle for 20-something years. And many years ago, her name popped up. I read something she wrote and I was like, oh, she's cool. Yeah, no. And then 5-6 years ago, whenever it was, I was like, who was that? As the brain works, it suddenly remembers something that's important. And so I Googled her and I was like, hey. And so we started working together.
What was it like to work with her in the beginning? You've mentioned already, you've worked with therapists, you've done a lot of self-work. How did this fit in emotionally for you?
So I am intuitive and I trust energy. You can imagine how this goes over well in the corporate world. When I meet somebody, I check in. How does that feel? How does that feel? And I either move forward or I don't. When we had our first conversation, I really liked your energy.
Money coaches are becoming more prevalent. There's a lot of people that are getting trained and going into that space. And it's great to know that there are people out there that are trained to help you along. And they're different than therapists. They're different than financial advisors. And they can be a very valuable team member to help a person or a couple, a family, make decisions and move forward and get what they want out of life and be their compassionate, authentic selves, especially as it relates to money.
Yes. And she spoke that language, which was crucial for me, because there are other money coaches who don't speak mindfulness heart language, and that wouldn't have worked for me. But that works very well for somebody else.
Which is another important point when you're hiring anyone to work with you, whether it's in regards to your personal finances or not, finding that connection, making sure that you're working with people who you really click with, who understand you, who hear you, and have all the expertise that they can bring into the conversations with you because of a long runway of career experience.
Amen.
Speaking of hiring, I want to ask one more question on this confidence you have around charging a lot because you're worth it. How would you coach our listeners towards getting to your value and getting to that confidence?
I've hired coaches over the years. I am a coach, so I need a coach. So I hired this coach and I said, you know, how can I charge? It's just so much fun and it's so easy for me. And she was like, so Rena, if you have a wait person who's taking your order and bringing you food and they're laughing and they're happy and they remember everything you want and they do a good job, do you want to give them more or less of a tip? And I was like, more. And she was like, exactly. And I was like, oh, It's easy for that person. They're having fun. They're good at it. Of course, I want to give them more money. And it was a whole mind shift for me to think about, just because it's easy for me and it's fun doesn't mean I shouldn't be paid for it. In fact, it means the opposite.
Such great points. Tell us, what's your next money conversation going to be, and who's it going to be with?
It's going to be with me, because I want to go to grad school and become a family therapist.
Wow. I did not see that coming.
I know. I love it.
So the other thing I do is parent coaching for parents of transgender, non-binary, gender questioning kids. And there's a lot of confusion and fear. And my whole life is this thread of replacing fear with compassion. This is my next career step.
That's so brave and exciting and impactful. I love it, Rena. What a great conversation you're going to have with yourself.
Yes.
Tell us, where's the best place for listeners to find you?
RenaDelevy.com. And also on Instagram and TikTok, I post regularly videos talking about parent coaching. You're a transgender, non-binary, gender questioning kid. You can find my TEDx talk on my site and the link to my book about compassionate leadership. And I hope to hear from you all.
That's great. And we'll link to those in the show notes and in your bio. Rena, it's been really amazing and inspiring to talk with you today on the Money Tales podcast.
Thank you so much. This has been really fun.
Thanks for listening to the Money Tales podcast. If you've enjoyed this episode, share it with someone you think would benefit from listening, and leave us a review on your favorite podcasting platform. Your ratings and reviews help more people find our podcast. If you're inspired to gain clarity and peace of mind about financial matters, don't hesitate to reach out to our team at Asperient. Go to asperient.com/start-a-dialogue, or you can email Sandy and me at podcasts@asperient.com. See you next time.